Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. In the chapter, Situation and Character in Simone de Beauvoir's work, The Second Sex, one of the themes that she's really going to highlight, and it's one that she's been talking about throughout the work, is the reduction of woman as a free being, as something that's capable of transcendence to the realm of immanence, and thereby being put on the same level as things. Even if one is talked about as a person, as a subject, there's still an objectification going on, a reduction to a thingly status. So she talks about this as women being forced into a condition of immanence. And when we say forced, we don't mean that there's some sort of, you know, corralling and a big roster and everyone has to check off their thing. Okay, you're not transcendent, you're immanent or anything like that. There's nothing like that happening. Rather, there's condition after condition after condition at each life stage, in each situation, showing women that they're not going to be treated and regarded and recognized the same as men, sometimes even quite inferior men, inferior in many other respects. Women are being given this status of immanence. And we could think, you know, just for example, of the stuff that still goes on today in how the female body is treated as an object and the male body is treated as a locus of agency in so many types of media, whether it be in terms of just sheer looking or who gets to have lines in movies or as characters. And we could go on and on and on with examples like this. And hopefully that won't be the issue decades from now, but it certainly is today, and it was very much so in Simone de Beauvoir's time. So women are forced into immanence, and one of the reasons why she says that women end up, you could say, fulfilling this expectation is because they have closed horizons. They are, in many ways, as she says, enclosed within the limits of one's ego, one's own conception of self, and all the accoutrements that go along with that, or the household. Today we could say, well, what about the workplace? That can still happen in the workplace too, particularly when some areas are regarded as being especially women's work. And we'll talk about that in a bit. But being enclosed within those limits and then not being afforded a full place in a larger male-dominated world. And you could say, well, wait a second, can't anyone go anywhere that they want to? How is a woman confined to the household if she's able to get on the train and go into the city and go to work and then come back home and go out, get in the car and drive out to a club or to a grocery store or a movie theater or to some sort of gathering or whatever you want, right? And there is some truth to that, but there are, without necessarily being, you know, completely male-dominated places, that's often gone by the wayside. There aren't so many old boys' clubs, but there's all of these different ways in which women are, in fact, unequal. I'll just give you one example. I've never had a male student in any of my many, many classes that I've taught tell me a story, a truthful story, about an attempted abduction on campus at night while he was walking, people trying to pull him into a van. I have had a female student tell me that story, and I suspect that that's not the only one who has run into situations like that. And I'm not using that to try to characterize everything or blow it up from an anecdote into a rule or something like that, but just to illustrate as an example what we're talking about here, not being afforded a full place in this larger male-dominated world that still remains in many respects. So, even if not necessarily every male is able to participate within that. So what is the net effect of this? Being forced into immanence means being treated as a thing, From an existential point of view, it means being treated as something that has its being in itself, not being for itself. Even if it does, in fact, have being for itself, because every human being does, that human being is not treated as such. And so there's no transcendence that is being recognized, sustained, supported, and there's a push back into more and more immanence. Now, I do want to point out one thing, that de Beauvoir doesn't let women off the hook for this. She doesn't say that it's just a matter of women being forced into this one-down position. She says that, you know, this is talking about sexual relations, but we could easily broaden this to all sorts of others. Man demands play acting. He wants her to be the other, but all existence remains subjects, try as they will to deny themselves. Man wants woman to be object. She makes herself object. At the very moment when she does that, she is exercising a free activity. Therein is her original treason. The most docile, the most passive is still a conscious being, and sometimes the fact that in giving herself to him, she looks at him and judges him is enough to make him feel duped. She is supposed to be only something offered, no more than prey. He also demands that this thing give herself over to him of her own free will. And so there's a dynamic going on there that can't possibly be satisfied, and it's essentially what the existentialists call bad faith. Now, de Beauvoir doesn't say that women are entirely responsible for that. As a matter of fact, she thinks that the male-dominated world has a greater responsibility. Let's look at one of the examples that she highlights in here, which I think is really quite apt, and we could extend it to many other things as well. And you probably have to exercise a little bit of imagination to think about what a kitchen was like in the day that she's talking about. So no microwave, no everything being meal planned in the refrigerator. Everything has to be done essentially from scratch. No, you know, highly processed foods, or if there are, you know, those are luxury items. There aren't a lot of mixes for things at the time that she's talking about. So here's what she says. And she makes a really interesting reference here to Martin Heidegger. Woman typically lacks the technical training that would permit her to dominate matter. It's not matter she comes to grips with, but life, and life cannot be mastered through the use of tools. The world does not seem to woman an assemblage of implements intermediate between her will and her goals, as Heidegger defines it. It's on the contrary, something obstinately resistant, unconquerable. It is dominated by fatality and shot through with mysterious caprices. So she goes on and she talks about the kitchen. Each day, the kitchen teaches her patience and passivity. And if you think about the sheer act of cooking, or doing laundry, or caretaking, or all these other things that we often call women's work, foolishly so, but that's a whole different topic, they do, in fact, involve a certain passivity and patience, particularly if they're not highly regarded, if they don't provide a source of transcendence. So she says, here is alchemy. One must obey the fire, the water, wait for the sugar to melt, for the dough to rise, also for the wash to dry, for the fruits to ripen on the shelf. Household activities come close to being technical operations. They don't provide transcendence. Why not? Because, she says, they're too rudimentary, too monotonous to prove to a woman the laws of mechanical causation. And things are capricious. They don't always turn out the way they should. There are materials that will stand washing, others that won't. Spots that can be removed, others that persist. Objects that break all by themselves. Dust that spring up like plants. And so, not just the kitchen, but the entire realm of household activities, mundane activities, is sort of a trap of immanence. She talks about it involving routine, monotony, a certain sort of temporality. She says, it's easy to see why woman clings to routine. Time for her has no element of novelty. It's not a creative flow because she's doomed to repetition. She sees in the future only a duplication of the past. If one knows the word in the formula, duration allies itself with the powers of fecundity, but this is itself subject to the rhythm of the months, the seasons, the cycle of each pregnancy. In this play of cyclical phenomena, the sole effect of time is a slow deterioration. It wears out furniture and clothes as it ruins the face. So this is a way of looking at the world and at things and at people in which no transcendence is really possible. And it ends up being a sort of connection to the world of things. And eventually one becomes something like a thing. She also talks about some of the criticisms of women in terms of immanence, particularly in relation to sensuality. And she says, many of the faults for which women are reproached simply express the fact that their horizon is closed. It is said that the woman is sensual, she wallows in immanence, but she's been first shut up in it. And you could ask, well, what does that mean then? Why engage? Why focus primarily on gratifying the senses in different ways? You might think of women, for example, who stay at home and redecorate and remodel their house over and over and over again, and then throw parties where their friends come and chit-chat about that and look through magazines about what else could be done there. That would be a prime example. Why do people do that? Well, there are three things that de Beauvoir actually talks about here. One is killing time. She brings up, for example, the harem slave feels no morbid passion for rose preserves and perfumes baths. She has to kill time. When a woman suffocates in a dull gynecium, brothel, or middle-class home, she's bound to take refuge in comfort and well-being, right? So that's another thing as well. It feels good. It feels nice. And these things afford consolations or compensations for the broader life and involvement and relationships that she's not having. Du Beauvoir has some great examples. Here she says, if she eagerly seeks sexual pleasure, it's very often because she's deprived of it. Sexually unsatisfied, doomed to male crudeness, condemned to masculine ugliness, she finds consolation in what? Creamy sauces, heady wines, velvets, the caress of water, of sunshine, of a woman friend, of a young lover. So you think about all the consumer products that we pitch to women so often. This body spray, this shower curtain to brighten up the house. Those are the compensations for a life that in some way is empty. And then there's the people who often say, well, why are you looking for this physical pleasure? Why are you, for example, having an affair? I wanted to feel alive. How often is that said? Well, she discusses that as well. And, you know, the call of the flesh, she says, is no louder in her than in the male, but she catches its least murmurs and amplifies them. Sexual pleasure, like rending pain, represents the stunning triumph of the immediate. In the violence of the instant, the future and the universe are denied. What lies outside the carnal flame is nothing. For the brief moment of this apotheosis, woman is no longer mutilated and frustrated. So those provide us with excellent reasons why one might do that. She also does talk about this occupation with things. Why is it that women seem to be so focused on having stuff, on accumulating materials? And she has this great discussion of means and ends here in the work. She says, if woman is earthy, commonplace, basely utilitarian, it is because she's compelled to devote her existence to cooking and washing diapers. It's her duty to assure the monotonous repetition of life in all of its mindless factuality. It's natural for women to repeat, to begin again without ever inventing, for time to seem to go round and round without ever leading anywhere. She is occupied without ever doing anything, and thus she identifies herself with what she has. Not what she could be, what she has. This dependence, as Du Beauvoir says, on things, a consequence of the dependence in which men keep her, explains her frugality, her avarice. Her life is not directed, this is the key point, towards ends. She is absorbed in producing or caring for things that are never more than means, such as food, clothing, and shelter. These things are intermediaries between animal life and free existence. The sole value that appertains to the essential means is utility. And she goes on to say that no existent can be satisfied with an inessential role. Why? For that immediately makes means into ends, as may be observed in politicians. And the value of the means comes to seem an absolute value. So she says, the utility reigns in the housekeeper's heaven above truth, beauty, liberty. And it is in this perspective she envisages the entire universe. what is this? This is another way of falling into immanence, into a realm of things, and coming after a while to treat oneself as just one more thing among them, not as a subject. So this is a very important diagnosis that de Beauvoir is engaging in. She's not saying that every single woman, she's not an essentialist, she's not saying this is the characteristic of all. She's saying that this is the sort of situation that so many women are forced into, and we can see that still going on today as well as in her own time when she was writing this book. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.